And so this talk is about the Fibonacci model and generalizations from the point of view of cuneiform spin networks. And I'll explain what I mean by that as I go along. I guess we should keep this in mind here. Let me do some items of business first. This is the first time I've given a talk on this without PowerPoint, so I thought it was about time to do that. The only problem is that the real numbers don't sound good. These are some references. And if you would like to see the PowerPoint, this is joint work with Sam Lamont. So let me begin by telling you about the Penrose's spin networks, which is what I'm going to be doing is using a generalization of the spin networks, which you probably all know, but you might not know about Penrose's way of doing things originally, so I thought I'd start there. What Penrose did was he is working with SU2 in the guise of SL2, which you can think of as the set of 2x2 matrices A epsilon. A transpose is equal to epsilon, where epsilon AB is the epsilon. That is, epsilon is two, there are two indices, so 0 and 1, and epsilon 0, 1 is 1, and epsilon 1, 0 is minus 1, epsilon 0, 0 is 0, and epsilon 1, 1 is 0, anti-symmetric tensor like that. And of course, that computes 2x2 determinants. And because of that, because he wanted to make a diagrammatic theory of angular momentum recoupling, and there have been various diagrammatic theories of angular momentum recoupling, he wanted to make one that had nice diagrams, and so reconstructing it a little bit, he has a diagram like this for the epsilon. I choose this not because it's pi, but because I'm going to make it a little smoother in a moment. But upper and lower indexed epsilons like that. And then he would have various diagrams in his system like this. And I'll show you, it gets more complicated. It's like the loop models that Paul was talking about a couple of days ago. And he wanted his diagrams to be topologically invariant so that it would be easy to write them, among other things. Topologically invariant in the plane. And these aren't because of the anti-symmetry of the epsilon. He figured out a way to readjust it so that it was. I should remind you about an identity about the epsilon. Well, maybe I won't. I'll just readjust it. They aren't topologically invariant in the plane if you leave it this way. But if you were to define this and multiply by the square root of minus 1, like that, and this one, be the square root of minus 1 multiplied by that, if you adjust them by multiplying by the square root of minus 1, then the diagrams... Pardon me? Yeah.
So I'm just going to follow your notation, because when I see a vertex with three lines coming out, I think it's a three tensor, and you're talking about a two tensor.
These aren't lines in that sense. So let's just make them. I just wanted to discriminate it from.
Okay.
I'm never going to draw them in anyway.
Okay. And then in your little zigzag diagram, those lines should go to. Okay.
You're Okay, so the only free ends in this tensor are the ones indicated. But he readjusted them by multiplying by the square root of minus one. And then he finds that, also there's the cross tronic or delta. A, B, C, D is delta A, B, delta B, C. But this is the way you would normally write it. You wouldn't think to necessarily put a minus sign in there, but he's going to put a minus sign there. Those are his readjustments, all right? So when lines or loops cross one another, they get a minus sign and like that, and then you find that you get this identity. I'll put a line through my zeros because I'll draw loops on the board and it gets confusing. And the value of the loop itself is minus two if you calculate it. That is to say, you sum. What this means is, I'm using diagrammatic matrices. So that means that you sum over all possible indices here and multiply the corresponding matrix elements together, and it gives you minus two, of course. And he wrote a paper entitled "On Negative Dimensional Tensors" a long time ago, back in the late 60s. Now, with 20/20 hindsight, of course, you see that this is a special case of a bracket polynomial, or a special case of the Jones polynomial, where the value of the variable is minus one. But for his purposes, he was, and therefore it is topologically invariant in the plane from what we already know. That's with 20/20 hindsight. But he discovered that he could make this adjustment and make it topologically invariant in the plane, good for his diagrams. And then he could set up his spin network technology, which involved using gadgets like this, some number of lines, let's say n, going into a box, is 1 over n factorial times the sum over permutations in Sn of, put the diagrammatic version of the permutation in here, and multiply by minus 1 to the sign of the permutation. So by diagrammatic permutations, I mean things like that. Okay? So you sum over all the elements in the symmetric group, replace each one by a diagrammatic permutation like that. So in the case of two lines, it would simply be this and this, right? And then, in fact, it would be this minus this multiplied by 1/2 would be the Penrose 2 projected, like that. And then, of course, this identity here, which he called the binary identity, allows you to expand all the crossings into things that have no crossings, so you get a loop expansion of the resulting things. These things are then going to sit in networks. The reason for having the anti-symmetrizer is because if you want to produce the irreducible, algebraically, if you want to produce the irreducible representations of SU2 from the two-dimensional representation, you need to form some tensor products and then sum over all permutations. That's the standard way of doing it. So this diagrammatically corresponded to that, and then a vertex corresponding to interactions of spins becomes modeled in his system by letting these gadgets, let's say this is A and B and C lines, these little gadgets be connected up to one another like this. Okay? Such that you have I lines, J lines, and K lines, and of course I plus J is A, J plus K is B, and so on. If you do a little arithmetic with that, you see you get the well-known restrictions on the spins in classical situation, namely A plus B minus C is greater than or equal to zero, and A plus B minus C is even, and so on. So this becomes the combinatorial picture for an A-half spin particle interacting with a B-half spin particle and projecting to the C-half spin representation. All done completely combinatorially. And then graphs, trivalent graphs with these vertices become what he calls his spin networks. And he showed informally in Twister newsletter you could do angular momentum theory with this, and how if you had a large network with a lot of free ends, you could kind of think of it as a precursor to a space where you could figure out something about the relationship between two free ends by doing an experiment, meaning a spin exchange between them. And he showed that for large networks that had repeatable experiments, these different free ends in this huge tensor look like directions in three-dimensional space. And he was hoping to be able to reconstruct space and space-time on the basis of networks of this kind. Yeah?
It was this box with two lines in, one out.
I'm sorry?
What is the box with two lines in, one out?
Oh, this means that something like this. Let me draw you a picture of one. Suppose you have three lines in here, three here, and these two went down here, and this one went over here, and these two went down here, and four came out. So it isn't two lines, it's some sub-collection of lines, and another sub-collection of lines, whose total adds up to the number of lines going in. Okay? Does that answer your question?
Yeah,
I just partitioned the lines in some way, shared them out. That means that that for large-ish A's, B's, and C's, there are various solutions to this, right? As indeed there are. I mean, if you choose an A and a B, there's various C's that you could write down. Yeah. Okay. So then you can form large networks of these, or you can think about recoupling theory. And the facts about recoupling theory are things like the fact that if you have something like this, it will be equal to some sum of coefficients multiplied by things like that, that you can rewrite, which amounts to basis changes, as we'll see in a moment. And there are other identities and so on. The basic point about these projectors is that they are projectors. If you take two of these and you multiply them together, you get it back. So that's a quick sketch of what Penrose was doing. And
just ask you, what is the status of that famous 1970 paper of Penrose? Did anyone ever fill in the details?
What is the status?
Well, the paper that you referred to with that blob.
You mean the one about the spin geometry?
Reconstructing free space, yeah. Did anyone work out the details in that paper?
Yeah, there's a student of his, Moussouris, who worked out the details of the theorem that he stated in his thesis, yeah. So I think the theorem is correct, but nobody has managed to, in the same way that Penrose was trying to do, reconstruct space-time. Maybe you need another group, maybe you need another idea.
Okay.
But the idea of getting space-time out of some combinatorial background is, of course, very much thought about by various people. So that's Penrose's spin methods. And then you would think that, I guess I'll erase this. You might think that anybody who looked at that would immediately try to turn it into a knot invariant. But the idea of turning everything into knot invariants didn't happen until later. So he didn't try to turn it into a knot invariant. And I think the knot invariants occurred to people before they realized that this was a special case of the bracket model. But the bracket model, let's talk about the bracket model for the Jones polynomial. So the bracket model gives you a non-invariant by what looks like what certainly is a generalization of what you see over there on the board. Namely, you have a recursive expansion which looks like this, and I'll put in the variables that make it into the non-invariant. There's some knot, and it gets multiplied by something. And if you choose these variables, and what I mean by this is that you start with a knot or a tangle, and you keep expanding it until everything is gone and it turned into a polynomial. So I could write bracket k equal to the result. And I could put brackets around this, but it's kind of laborious to put a bracket around it. so I won't, I just write it as an identity, but you see what will happen if you use something like that. If you started with a not, then it would go to A times times that plus A inverse times that, and then that would go and so on, and after a while you have a polynomial and the knot would have disappeared. So that's one way of thinking about this loop expansion of the knot. And another way of thinking about what I mean by this is, as I said, I started to say, that you can think of this as a sum over certain states of the diagram, products of vertex weights multiplied by the delta raised to the number of loops. Because that's what these rules are actually telling you. So you can think about it either way. And with this choice of variables, it's invariant of regular isotopy, which means that it's invariant under the flat braided kind of knot loops like these. But it has some framing going on like that when you bring another little curl. So this is certainly a generalization of that, and I'm not going to talk about how the algebra comes in, because you might think, well, if that's a matrix identity, then this should be a matrix identity, and it can be a matrix identity, but I'm not going to do it algebraically. I'm just going to use it this way and talk about how one can generalize Penrose's spin network. So indeed, there's lots of algebra and quantum algebra here, but if you were to just say, let's generalize Penrose's spin network theory, basing it on the Jones polynomial in this sense, using this identity rather than the other, then what would it look like? And it looks like this. That you replace the projectors by some formula that is a deformation of the other quantum. I'm not going to have to use these formulas except in the simplest case today. I thought I'd exhibit it just for fun. Now, T of sigma now means the least number of transpositions needed to return the permutation to the identity. And sigma tilde means something like this, that you have this and permutation, and then you turn it into a braid in a standard way. And so that's a generalization of Penrose's projectors in exactly the spirit of that. And that turns out to be exactly the same as what people call the Jones-Wenzel projector. So you may be familiar with the Jones-Wenzel projector. This is just another way of doing it, but it puts the connection between this and Penrose's ideas, okay? The simplest case of this is probably the only one that I want to use today for any calculation, so let's write it down and have it on the board. So the simplest one is just this. After you do what we were just talking about, namely, you replace all those braided crossings by things that have no crossings and collect up the terms. And then there's the simplest Jones-Wenzel projector, two strands, okay? And then all this Penrose technology goes over and you have a nice recoupling theory where the vertices look like this. And of course the dimensions are no longer negative, they can take all kinds of values. So that's a picture of connecting up to a couple of things. One is that you can make this kind of recoupling theory just on the basis of the knot theory and the diagrammatics without any background coming from some other theory in which it might have been built, like things like this exist in conformal field theory and other things. But you can build it straight from the knot diagrams by using Penrose's ideas, and you have formulas like this, and it's braided, of course. Now it's braided, And you get, which you didn't get, of course, in the old theory, you get some formula that says that if this is A and this is B and this is C, then there will be some factor. And that happens in there. So, and then all those identities that one wants for this kind of a recoupling theory, the pentagon and the hexagon and so on, they're automatic. They just come out of the topology. So it's a nice way to build this sort of theory. And what I wanted to show you is how nicely the Fibonacci model and some of its generalizations just come straight out of this. And in the case of the Fibonacci model, we can do a few of those calculations, and I thought it would be fun to do it. Because the model is the simplest thing that you can make out of this, in a certain sense.
At this point, is there any restriction on A, or yeah. is it completely arbitrary?
Pardon me?
Is there any restriction on your coefficient A at this point?
Oh, there. No, not at this point. Not at this point. No. No roots of unity or anything. I can make the networks and I can evaluate things, and there are formulas like the Biedenhorn-Elliott identity and all of that. Sure. But then if you want to make different kinds of constructions, you find yourself being forced into roots of unity, and we'll see that here as well. So now let's remember the Fibonacci model. So there's this particle P, which has the property that when it interacts with itself, it either produces itself or it produces a null particle, right? And so I'm looking for some situation where the particle interacts with itself and it either produces a null particle or it produces itself. And I would like to create that using this formula. So if you look at the two projector in this form, and ask, you think of the two, in terms of these diagrams, you think of the two projector itself as the particle, right? The particle interacted with the particle to produce that particle. So if it's two, then one of the possibilities is this, and the other possibility is this. So there it is, iconically. And of course, there is one further possibility for two projectors to interact, and that would be that all four of these came down on the rule of four. So I'm not interested. So I'm going to do an exercise where I'm going to land on the root of unity that's needed, and not by previously constructing the algebra that tells me that if I chose that root of unity, this would be zero. Which is one way to do that. I mean, if you use a little more of this construction, then you can check that in certain roots of unity, some of these guys vanish. I'm just going to assume that the recoupling theory for this only involves these two instances and nothing else. Okay, and then we can see how it just comes out of the calculation. It's fun, but maybe I should remind you of a couple more things about what the braiding representation is going to be in the end.
So you're going to demonstrate
before I start doing this calculation. Yeah.
Excuse me. You're going to demonstrate that the upper one won't appear or special.
Well, no. What I'm going to do is a kind of consistency calculation, and then after I've made the calculation, I could prove to you that it doesn't appear because it vanishes. But I'm going to assume it isn't there, and then ask what would the coefficients be for the recoupling, and then they come out. So that's kind of fun to do it that way. But I want to remind you about the model. Of course, many people have talked about this week, so there isn't much need to remind. But if you start with something like a bunch of p's, and you want a p to come out, for example, and you ask what could happen in between, well, this could be null, but then if this is null, then it interacts with p and produces a p. You can't get two nulls in a row. You get these different possible sequences, and the collection of sequences is a basis for the vector space. diagram, a tree like that. So each tree has a vector space, and you have to specify the top and the bottom of the tree in order to do that, like I've done here. But then, if you have that vector space and you have the spaces, then you can think about what would happen if you did some grading here. And so then the question is, what does the what does that network theory tell you about the braiding? And in this case, it tells you directly that there's going to be some multiple of this being changed. On the other hand, if, for example, it was this one, then it doesn't tell you directly, but it tells you indirectly, because you have an isomorphism to a related vector space sitting over here, like this, and then there is some direct braiding here, and then this can go back by the inverse of that isomorphism to where we started. And so you end up with a mapping from the vector space to itself by using the recoupling theory. So this is the expansion using the 6J coefficients. And so one wants that to be unitary, and one wants and this is given to be unitary if we have some roots of unity for the A. So one wants this to be a unitary composition, so that all of the braiding is represented by unitary transformations on the space. And so that's the aim. And we're going to see that happen here in a simple example and in some generalizations of it. In the simplest case of this, like that, there are two possibilities here. And so that space is two-dimensional, and so you're going to get out of this kind of formalism unitary representations of the break group, three-strand break group on a qubit space, and then coherently up to various other dimensional spaces. That's not so easy to create by other means, so it's nice to have this picture of doing it through the recoupling. So that's the reason for using this recoupling formalism in order to do this. So let's see how this game works using this diagrammatic method. Well, I don't want to do all the identities, but I want to do a few just so you see how it plays out. So we're starting with this guy. I leave it to you to check that if you take and square it, then you get it back. On the other hand, let's take a look at what happens if I tie the line at the bottom to itself. Then you get this minus 1 over delta times that. But this is delta, so this is 0. So if you tie a line at the bottom of one of these projectors, it vanishes. And then that leads to some other things that are important. Like, for example, suppose you had a little loop at the end of something like that, a little pendant loop. Then what happens here? I'm going to go back and forth between lines that should be labeled 2 and not drawing the 2. Okay. And actually drawing the 2. But every once in a while, when I'm calculating, I end up with a single loop, which has to be, which you have to remember is either 2 loops or 1 loop, depending on the context. So that's just the way life is. So let's see what we got here. I just wanted to do this one out. So I have that, right? And then on the other hand, that is that, because it's a projector, and then you expand it, that this guy's a projector, so you expand it, and you get this plus 1 over delta times that. if you have a pendant loop, it's zero. It's important.
Trivial, but important.
And the other fact is that if you have a little loop like this in the middle, then this is equal to theta divided by delta multiplied by the line. There's the line. I'll put a 2 on it, because otherwise you might think it was a single line. But they're all 2s. It's just that sometimes maybe I should say so. So why is that? Well, if you close the, well, theta. Theta is this. This looks like some kind of notational identity. But what I mean by the theta on the right is, of course, the evaluation of that, which means you take the bracket sum and until it's gone and turned into a polynomial or a number. And so if you were to close the top and the bottom of this, then it would be true, wouldn't it? Because you'd have theta on the right-hand side and you'd be multiplying by delta, but I didn't play what delta was. Delta is the evaluation of 2. That is, it's equal to this evaluation. And of course, what is that? It's getting to be time to stop doing these out. So I'll just write delta squared minus 1. You just expand it and you see you get 2 parallel lines, and that's the delta squared, and then you get a backup multiplied by 1 over delta, you get 1. So it's delta squared minus 1. So this guy is delta multiplied by delta, and you get theta. So you have this formula here. Now, there are a couple of other things that I'll need later, and I think I'll make a little chart one of them. We won't calculate all of them, but they all calculate. In the case of 2 strands, they all get calculated very easily. So let me see where they were. Yeah. So delta, which is equal to the evaluation of this guy, is delta squared minus 1. Theta is equal to delta minus 1 over delta quantity squared multiplied by delta minus delta over delta. And t, which I didn't mention yet, is given by this. These are all fun to do, but you don't want to watch them do that. So this is t, the tetrahedron. Okay. We'll need it later. So those are some things that I might need. Now it becomes axiomatic because we have these properties. So I'll put those properties here too somewhere. That if you have a pendant loop, then it's equal to 0. And if you have a loop in the middle of something, then it's equal to theta over delta multiplied by that. Okay. And then what other properties do I want to have in order to try to do this? Well, they're this. I'll put a little dotted line there. That's the null. This would be the recoupling formula. And the F would be A, B, C, D. Okay? So those are the coefficients that I'm looking for. And then here's a fact that requires another calculation. That if you have this guy, then it's A to the A times this. And if you have this guy, comes from grading that vertex and seeing what you get. Okay, but these are the people I'm interested in, those are the recoupling formulas that I want to know about. So so how do we get them? Well, let's look at this, for example. I'm looking for A and B so that this would be true. Right? Well, if I close it top and bottom in some way, some things will vanish. For example, if I closed it this way, then I get two loops here, but here I get pendant loops. So that tells me that that this, which remember there are twos on these lines, so this is telling me that it's telling me that delta is equal to A delta squared. And the B went away, and so that tells me that A is equal to 1 over delta. Now, let me do one more and stop. Let's see. Let's suppose that I'm looking at this one. Okay. So I'm looking at the second equation, and I'd like to get one of those. This is the other kind of thing that can happen. I want to close it this way, but if I just closed it that way, I would get the C. But if I close it this way, then this will go away, and this will come in. And now I have a tetrahedron. So I just to illustrate, you get a tetrahedron, right? And so in this case, what we will get is that D is equal to the tetrahedron multiplied by delta divided by theta squared. Because here's the tetrahedron, this went to zero, and when you look at this, you pull, remember, you pull out a theta over delta, and then you're left with a theta, so you get a theta squared over delta. And so you get that the D is T delta over theta squared. So so let me write down what the result is. The result is 1 over delta, delta over theta over delta squared, and T delta over theta squared. Okay? By doing those, by using that orthogonality that comes from this identity and the fact that the pendant loop vanishes, you can find out exactly what the coefficients would have to be. The T doesn't look beautiful. Okay? So what's the next step? The next step, or we don't want to take too much time here. The next step is to think about this for a moment. What is it that we want? What is it about this that we want? We would like this to be unitary, real, in fact. So it should be symmetric. It doesn't quite look symmetric, so that's a problem. And also, on the other hand, if I rotate all of these pictures by 90 degrees, I will get the formulas for F inverse. So what I want is, so that tells me that that I want F squared to be equal to the identity. That should be, turning it around like that is just giving me F back, and I want F squared to be equal to the identity. But we also want, but let's talk about adjusting the vertices. So I'm going to fix it to make it symmetric. Let me do that first. So to fix it to make it symmetric, I'm going to take each of the vertices, and I'm going to replace it by something times that vertex. Because the matrix doesn't look symmetric to begin with, but we'd like to make it symmetric. What will that do? Think about what it does to each of these coefficients. Let me just write the matrix will go to, and you can write down what it will go to if I were to multiply by somebody. Okay. So delta itself has no vertices, so it won't change. T has 4. Delta has none, and theta has 2, so theta squared has 4. So T delta over theta squared won't change either. And then delta over theta will become delta over alpha squared theta, and theta over delta squared will become alpha squared theta divided by delta squared, because theta has two vertices like that. So that means that I need that alpha squared theta over delta squared should be equal to delta over alpha squared theta, which means that alpha should be equal to alpha to the fourth should be delta cubed over theta squared. And if you use that alpha, then this will turn into 1 over delta, 1 over the square root of delta, 1 over the square root of delta, just algebra from there, and T delta over theta squared. And now you can ask more easily, what does it mean that F squared should be equal to the identity? You want to square this matrix, here's F again, right? Rising out of the ashes there. F squared equals the identity. So F squared equals the identity implies, square it in your head, and you get 1 over delta squared plus 1 over delta equals 1. That's the upper left-hand corner entry of the matrix, right? So that suggests, well, it doesn't suggest, it tells us that delta squared equals delta plus 1. Let's think about that for a moment. So there's a Fibonacci number coming in, right? The golden ratio is coming in. And on the other hand, we knew that that delta was equal to little delta squared minus 1, right? So that says that delta plus 1 equals delta squared equals little delta squared. So we ought to have capital delta equal to little delta equal to the golden ratio. Okay, there, now we're on the Fibonacci model, that's the point. So then if we take that, taking delta equal to 1 plus the square root of 5 divided by 2, corresponds to taking A equal to e to the 3 pi I over 5, so that delta equals minus A squared minus A to the minus 2 is equal to minus 2 cosine of 6 pi over 5, which is equal to the golden ratio. Those parameters are the ones that are suggested to us here. And then the F will be equal to 1 over delta, 1 over the square root of delta, 1 over the square root of delta, and minus 1 over delta. And I daren't do that calculation, but you can do it now because it's just over there. You just put in the golden ratio into the formula for T and check, and that works. So and then as far as the R is concerned, it's e to the I 4 pi over 5 e to the minus e to the 2 pi over I over 5 diagonal matrix, sorry, the diagonal matrix. That's the Fibonacci model. Okay. So it's an amusing and not very hard calculation to see how the Fibonacci model just comes straight out of the two-strand version of the Jones polynomial like this. I think I have a couple more remarks to make. I think, do I have enough time for that? This is supposed to end. So that's how to see the Fibonacci model in these terms. The fix that I suggested to make to adjust things so that the recoupling transformation is unitary, the fix with alpha, is more general. If you're doing the full recoupling theory, then you have to fix an arbitrary vertex, and the fix turns out to be delta A, delta B. There's the delta cubed, see, divided by theta, multiplied by the that's the fix that works in general to make the to make the transformation symmetric, the recoupling transformation symmetric, the 6J coefficients. Now, I haven't checked, but in standard treatments like Biedenharn and Luke, I think they make their 6J coefficients symmetric anyway, and they probably went through some transformation like this. But when you start with the knot theory, it ends up looking non-symmetric to begin with, and then it gets symmetrized like this. And then some nice things happen here. If you take the A's generally to be e to the I over 2i, which is slightly, which is a general situation, then these coefficients are real, and the recoupling transformation is a real matrix that's unitary, and you get unitary, the same kind of arguments, just with the rest of the recoupling theory algebra, give you representations of the Braid group that are unitary for many, many roots of unity like that. It's the same thing, same calculation, just more spins. That's one comment. The other comment is about the two-strand theory. You can ask, well, what kind of non-invariant am I getting in this two-strand theory? And in general, if you consider some knot and you put an A on the line like that, that's called the colored Jones polynomial, or the colored bracket polynomial of the knot, okay? Like that, where you put in the eighth irreducible representation on the line. So this is a combinatorial way of saying what those invariants are, and so we can wonder, well, what is this two-stranded invariant? And that's where this seems to connect with the things that Paul was saying. You see, in the two-stranded invariant, there are projectors all over the place. And you can figure out what kind of skein relation is in this two-stranded invariant on which we base that model. How can this expand out? We're going to expand all of these out. But a lot of them are going to go away. The ones where the strings come back like this will go away because the projectors kill them off. And all you're left with, I'll just write down the formula, is a to the fourth times what you get when you go this way plus a to the minus fourth times what you get when you go this way. Plus delta times a vertex, you might say. Okay. So this is a formula of the following abbreviated type. Vertex. So it's very analogous to the kind of formula that you were writing about.
It must be almost the same thing.
And if you take the difference, well, it's the Berman-Wenzel algebra. If you think of it as a representation of braids, or it's one of the knot polynomials if you look at it that way. And so that's the Fibonacci model is sitting on top of that invariant directly. It's sitting on top of the Jones polynomial a little bit indirectly because you have to double the strands. It's sitting on top of this knot polynomial directly. And then the other remark I wanted to make was about calculating quantum calculations of knot invariants. Let's just draw a little picture. Suppose that you had a braid like this. Suppose I have a braid like this and it's acting on this little network here. Then this gives me a unitary transformation acting on that vector space down there, right? On the other hand, let's specialize this so that these are all A's in some choice of the general situation there. and that the bottom of the the bottom parts are given to be 0, 0, and 0 to begin with, all right? So then they aren't there. These are just null. And what I have is a flat closure sitting at the bottom of the break, right? If I close it at the top, why then I will be talking about the evaluation of the eighth Jones polynomial at that flat closure. So on the other hand, this is equal to some sum over the basis of the vector space, sum over x, y, some coefficients b, x, y, multiplied by, it's going to have 0 coming out in the basis. I'm allowing these to change. My vector space is a arbitrary and 0 on the bottom. That's the vector space. So you have x and y here. You have some a's here. So, and this matrix here is unitary. That's our construction. All right? So, so if we close the top and evaluate, we pick up a matrix entry. And we only pick up one, because if these x's are non-zero, then these pendant loops cause it to vanish. So this is exactly equal to b0, 0 times two loops. So this is equal to b0, 0 times delta a squared. And on the other hand, since these are zeros, I didn't really have them there. And I find that the evaluation of this link invariant is essentially one diagonal term of this unitary matrix. So if you can determine one diagonal term of some unitary matrix by quantum computation, then you've calculated this link invariant. Well, you can. You can use the Hadamard test to find diagonal terms of a unitary matrix. So that means if you have a relatively efficient quantum algorithm for computing the eighth colored Jones polynomials of Platt closures like this, it's general. And then if you want, you can compute the Witten-Reshetikin-Turayev invariant, for example, by regarding it as a sum of evaluations of links of this type with coefficients. So you have to do a number of diagonal entries rather than just one. Okay. So so one of the things that this way of thinking leads to is some specific quantum algorithms for computing Jones polynomials and Witten-Reshetikin.